Accession number 26561, Reel 11.
Wing Commander Bernard, Reel 11. Now, I'd like you to tell us as much as possible about the sort of methodology of tunnelling, how you actually did it, and the sort of dangers and experiences you had. From any point you like, really. From, you know, you told us how you started from the cesspit.
Yes, and what we did, we offloaded the first lot of earth into the cesspit itself and built a little island to bridge it to the emptying end toilet, which had a lid on it and a hinge so one could climb down through it and attack the coal face.
Now, what tools did you have?
Well, I only used a fork to loosen it and a scoop made from tin can with a cutaway, so that it was, well, a scoop. And that got bent very frequently, but it was statted out. I also had a fire bar for any that had been pinched off a stove and replaced with a piece of wire springing in its stead. This was where the door of the stove was tensioned to seal it off to get the right draft. And those made excellent hammers and tools. With a pair of those would make a lovely pair of wire cutters. They're about a foot long and had a hole in the centre where the tensioning screw went.
And now, tell me, what were the dimensions of the tunnel that you were digging?
The tunnel was governed by the bedboard width, which was about 2 foot six wide, if that. I never measured it, but that was our guide, because we were going to use bedboards for the shoring up of the tunnel as we proceeded.
So it was 2 foot six square, was it?
Yeah, that's right.
When you boarded it out, how did you actually do it? Was it boarded on all four sides, or just three sides?
No,
or
three sides. And
did you fit them continuously, or every?
No, we spread the load. It was a sandy soil, quite good, very very soft it was, and there were a lot of old roots from the former tree forest that covered the area, and these were, I say, the roots that were there in the soil helped enormously. But we back it up with Red Cross cartons straightened out, and they got soggy, but they spread the load around these bed boards for tunnelling.
They were just cardboard, were they?
Yes.
But they still helped?
Oh, yes. They spread the load behind the bed boards.
Now, so how far would you get it? What was it? What was a typical shift down like, down the thing? How was it organised for you?
On the short tunnels, it was about an hour at the most. You were really whacked at the end of that time. And
what was it like down there, digging?
Claustrophobic, yes. Very claustrophobic. And until we got the air pumping going, we had to dig a sort of a bigger cave-like structure for the pump to go in later on.
Well, we'll come to that. So what about this claustrophobia? Tell me how you felt when you were down there.
Well, breathing was bad because you didn't get the flow of air there. And by the time when it extended, of course, you were whacked when you got to the coal face.
And what about the smell? I mean, was there still that?
Oh, ghastly, yes. And you work naked because you couldn't soil the clothes that you were going, and there was a cold water shower on top adjoining the toilet.
And how many would be down at a time?
Oh, just the one. There was only room for one at a time.
So how did you get the dirt back? you know, the stuff you dug out.
Oh, you put it on. Oh, there'll be somebody working on the in the cesspit entrance, and a rope had a aluminium washing bowls that big, and put a hole in those and put a cord on them, and they were dragged in behind you going. And you left the cord, which was made out of Red Cross string, was pulled to pull it back with a soil in it. And then it was offloaded discreetly inside the washroom. And
How would you... That's once, but how would you get the next lot back? Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Because you take your thing forward.
We had two cords on, as I remember, one at each end of the... and one for dragging it, and one for sending it back.
So, and you'd be doing this for about an hour?
Yes. And it was quite a lot. It was very hard work. And you found breathing was difficult until we got the air pump in.
Now, tell us about the air pump. Who built this, and how was it designed?
I didn't build the first one. I built a subsequent one, because this one wasn't very good. It was made out of a kit bag, an RAF kit bag, with wire loops inside to give the concertina effect. It was in a trough-like box made from Canadian Red Cross packet cases, and it had a handle on it, again made out of pieces of wood from the bedboard. And you push this to and fro, and it had a plywood place, again from the Canadian Red Cross boxes, tea chest shaped things, and it would have a thin piece of actually a bit of flying boot top, which was leather, as a flap valve, and you would keep that well lubricated and soft, so that it flapped back when you pulled and pushed.
And who would be doing the pulling and pushing?
The chap in the entrance to the tunnel inside the cesspit.
And how well did this work? Because presumably it was only pulling air from the area of the cesspit. So
no, we had an air, and we built later on. We built this chamber to one side, and that had a venting pipe, which we drew the air in from. All the conduct was done by, all the air flow was done by Climtins, which were fairly big tins, which had a flange for the lid that went on it, and rather like a bully beef tin, where you undid a piece of metal tape around the lid, and then there was a ring behind that to push it on, and that... They made very good, and you'd take the other end of the bottom end of the Climtin out, and they would interface each other beautifully.
So the first air pump, where did that get its air from? Did that have a ventilation shaft, or was that just...
That was just to the outside of the toilet, as I...
So it did have a ventilation...
Oh, yes, it didn't just take it from the surface of the cesspit.
And you improved it. Tell me about the one you built. It was for this tunnel, was it?
It was somewhat similar, yes, but I had a better slide arrangement for pushing and pulling the kit bag, which pushes the air down the thing with the hoops in it. And later I built a plywood hoops out of Canadian Red Cross boxes. Packing cases,
And that just that worked better.
Yeah.
And now, what about roof falls and the dangers? What could you go talk a bit about the dangers of this tunnel? Because it sounds dreadfully dangerous to me.
Yes. Well, of course, later on, but not in that tunnel that I was working on. Those early ones, we learnt a lot from those.
What were you learning?
We're learning tunnelling. We didn't have any tunnelling experts with us. It was all very amateurish. Other big tunnels, like the ones that were built subsequently in Luft 3, had a mining engineer to do. We didn't have a mining engineer in our community.
So you found the experience valuable later on?
Oh, yes. I always thought that Bath was a prep school for learning to be a prisoner of war.
Now, you didn't have any roof collapses then, or any particular...
Not on that one. This was a fairly short run, you see. This was the whole advantage. They had tunnel failure. I didn't work on those at previous attempts. But they didn't get very far, and they did have a lot of tunnels going down.
Now, you also built a clinometer, didn't you?
Yes, there's
a diagram of this amongst the papers that they'll see.
Right, yes.
Could you describe what exactly? I mean, I know we can look at it, but I mean, so that people can understand what you did and what were the purpose of it was and how it all worked.
One should remember that tunneling underground, you've got no references to know which way you're going unless you have some instrumentation. And we would build our own compasses. We were very good at compass building at this time, which was made in all sorts of things. The pivot was for the compass was a piece of toothbrush handle with two pieces of broken, little short broken pieces of a darning needle, and they were magnetized by going to the propaganda loudspeaker and stroking the loudspeaker magnet in order to polarize these pieces of needle, and they would swing on a pivot, which was in fact a gramophone needle.
So that was the compass. Now that's an integral part of the clinometer, isn't
it? Yes, that gives you the direction you're travelling in. Now also, you have to start, if you're going to find an incline, you've got to start from a level basis. And there we've got a bottle which was turned into a spirit level, a long, small chemistry bottle, a sort of, I think, a medical prescription bottle or something like that. And they put a mixture, emulsified water and an oil from boiling down margarine, just to give it a mix. And this created a bubble in there, which was set. And one used a pail of water to float this on to get the markings on the bottle for what... zero incline. The next part was the sighting device, which was a piece of again good old bedboard cut into a beam, like and that had a sight at the front and the sight at the back, rather than the form of a rifle. And in the middle of it, on the pivoting of the middle of it, was a protractor, a homemade protractor with the various degree angles, and suspended again on this beam was a bob weight with a lead weight on the bottom and some multiple cotton made into a black drop. So one had a vertical and the true one, and if you want to set this up on two, what we call them, like tent pegs, and knock it into the ground and make sure it was level as a starter, and then it was sighted there. The height above the whole device, so that that was sighting level on this beam, had to be exact, and you put it a zero and then it was level, and then you got at the far end of the coal face end, one had another piece of wood with a fat lamp mounted on top, and the two heights of the devices had to be critical to get your incline correct. So really, I mean, you're tunnelling underground, you've no references at all, and the reason for it was we knew that the Germans had built a V-shaped ditch all the way round the outside of the camp, as well as the microphones, seismograph microphones in the soil. And so we wanted to get under that V-shaped disc in our tunnelling. But unfortunately, people didn't get the setting up heights correct. Not myself.
We'll come to that. Just a bit more about the tunnel before, because that's when the tunnel was discovered. How many were there actually working on the tunnel? I mean, you know,
there was
you were down for an hour. How many hours?
We'd only operate in daylight on top, because there'd be about 10 of us all together, I suppose. Team of 10, it varied. Some couldn't.
So about stand. 8 shifts a day or
something?
Of an hour?
Yes. We had to be careful because it was internal, the ferrets we called them, the internal security guards who were on the move all the time. But their position was reported through the duty pilot.
Tell me about what system was set up. Was the duty pilot system set up at Bath?
He was set up near the entrance to the car, and people reported into him where the German ferrets were. We call them ferrets because they were interested in tunneling.
And that system worked?
Yes, I think it it was very efficient. It was dedicated from dawn to dusk.
Now, what about the disposal of the earth?
Yes, that was done by in those days, because there was no heating in aircraft, people had long john underpants which came down to their ankles. Now, these were cut off, and they made ideal sacks for putting down the trouser leg filled with earth. The bottom was folded over with a nail through it and a piece of string tied to the head of the nail and into one's trouser pocket. So if you pulled that in, the nail came out and the soil fell out from the bottom that had been folded over.
Now, were they by then called penguins? I mean, or did that name come in later?
I don't know when it came in, but very shortly, because they were with two loads of earth down each trouser leg. One didn't have a very nimble promenade.
Did you used to do this as well as doing the digging, or was this other people?
I'd had enough by the time I'd overcome that hour down there and go on top and I'd hidden my clothing wherever it was, I'd shower and shower and shower, but the memory lingered on.
And was the earth a different colour?
It was a sandy structure.
And was that the same though as the stuff on the top? I mean, could you see?
No, the top had a sort of a blackish leaf mould, because it had been trees there, so it was. And then, but as soon as you got down about a foot, you were into sand.
So, couldn't where the penguins dropped the earth? Couldn't it be easily seen?
Oh, very much so. Yes, they'd go to a football match, which was going on inside the camp, and a discreet point, go in the trouser pocket and pull the string, and then shuffle it around. And there was crowds there. No one could see the activity going on.
Now tell me how this turned, because the clinometer, the clinometer failed, but you started saying, but could you just explain now why it all went wrong, and how long had you been doing it before it went wrong?
Weeks and weeks. I didn't keep a diary, unfortunately.
So
it seemed a long time.
What went wrong?
Oh, well, what happened was that we got the angle wrong because of this setting up procedure. Some of the tunnellers didn't realise that the starting height was critical, both on the platform of the clinometer and its sighting target. They had to be the same to get the correct angle that you were digging at.
So what happened?
So, well, what happened with the German, they'd broke into the side of this V trench, and the Germans knew those.
Were you on duty? Were you digging when that happened?
No,
or was that
no,
someone else?
No, I was stood down. Well, I think it was discovered early morning from the previous day.
Had they actually broken right through? Could they not sort of put it back?
Not from inside the tunnel, no. You could have done it from outside, but we had no friendly guards who could do that.
So it was fairly obvious, wasn't it?
Oh, very apparent, yes. They just that's why they dug it that way.
So what happened then? I believe that this...
They got a Ruski, a prisoner of war, and they tied a giant ball. It must have been binder twine or something like that. They wanted to find out where it came, so they didn't fancy... The ferrets didn't fancy going underground, so they sent this thing with this binder twine attached to him down from the V-shaped trench through to the, and the scene now changes to the surfacing of this Russian, and there's only one, and it's late morning, and the rush for the toilets had finished, and this one man was reading his Tauchnitz novel, which is a bit like a Swiss Penguin book, soft pack, and he would read a page and use a page, because that's all they had. And all of a sudden, one of the trapdoors nearby opened, and the head of this Ruski appeared from the bowels of the cesspit.
Must have given him a shot.
And he was shaken, and this one Aria prisoner, and he offered him a cigarette. It's just as well he didn't light it up, because the methane gas was enormous in that area.
So what did the Germans do next then? I mean,
I don't know what the follow up was. It was obviously filled in.
I was wondering how they filled it in. I mean,
I didn't see it. I didn't. No way of knowing.
So where were you then?
I was in my hut, keeping my head down. Yes.
So you wouldn't know what they did.
No. But
Well, I was going to. One thing I forgot to ask was: were there many precautions taken to keep the noise down in tunneling because of these microphones? I know we've got past that.
No, later on, they do this three-way business. But I think the German seismograph king must have known that they were going where it was going and where it was coming through.
So at the time you couldn't. Were you trying to be quiet while you were tunneling, or were you not aware of it?
Just trying to survive and get the tunnel going.
So you no particular emphasis on being quiet.
No, but one should realise that shoveling sand isn't a noisy business. Forcing the bedboards into the sides and the ceiling of the tunnel were important, but. They were pushed rather than hammered.
So were people very disappointed? I mean, you'd spent so much time. I mean, how did you feel when the tunnel was found?
Oh, dejected, of course. And it wasn't long after that that they closed Bath, Stalaglov Dam 1, and we went to open up Stalaglov 3, which was brand new. And they then expanded the old Stalaglov 1 to by factor of 10, I think.
So, do you know when you moved?
Yes, so I in fact got a list of the people that were done on a German typewriter via man. I think it was June 42.
And what do you remember about the move?
Before we leave Bath.
Fine.
There's two incidents that are worthy of recording. One of the escapes was this quagmire parade ground. I think we had a lot to do with it when we formed our ice rink on it. Put a lot of water on the surface, and there was some sort of water table there, and it was a pile of mud, and the guards didn't like standing up to their ankles in mud, so they shipped in a lot of drainage pipes, short, about 30 centimetres long, a foot long, and typical red clay baked pipes, and they were piled up inside the camp. And somebody had a brilliant idea very quickly. The speed with which they undertook this project for escape was most commendable. Some of them dressed up as Russian workers, no matter to look like German workers. One who spoke German fluently, dressed up in a homemade German uniform with his wooden imitation rifle, and marched these characters in. And I don't know where they got their shovels from, but they had the long spade-shaped shovels over their shoulders, and he marched them in, this dummy guard marched them in to the location of the pipes, which were stacked up, and commenced to dig a V-shaped trough all the way, and they were laying pipes right down up to the no man's land point, and this imitation German guard called up to the machine gun towers and said, "We're coming through with this drainage system." And they're just about to start that. On the other side of the outside of the wire, our favourite but respected Glemnitz, German warrant officer Glemnitz, stood there with his legs akimbo and his arms on his hips and said, "Gentlemen, what are you up to now?" And they all had to do a spell in the cool for, I think, less than a week, which was going into the cooler was a recreation for getting peace and quiet all to yourself.
This is Glemnitz. Was Glemnitz a bit of a character in that? I'm not sure we've talked about Glemnitz yet.
Yes, I think I mentioned him outside this interviewing. Yes, he was a parachute warrant officer, German parachute, who'd been parachuted into Crete, joined the Crete business. And in fact, my chum used to, Bunny Austin, used to discuss the battle from the two sides of the front. And Glemnitz could never understand why we gave in, the Brits gave in, and the Brits couldn't understand why the Germans gave in. They were both out of ammunition. But the Germans prevailed and they had more numbers. But he was very good. He was very, very honest and a very sincere story. Man, and he respected us, and we respected him because he was a good soldier. Yeah.
Now, tell me, there was another incident you were going to tell us beside this failed.
Oh yes, I was walking around the officers' compound was it was rather like a checkerboard. There was officers' compound there, and adjoining point. In the sort of diagonally was the two points meeting was the NCO's compound, and I was walking around this, my usual wolf prowl around the group perimeter for exercise purposes, and I saw the guards coming out of the officers' compound. It was late and just beginning to get dark, and I saw the guards coming from an appel coming out of the officer's compound, and I thought, "That's a funny guard. I don't know that guard on the end there." And it turned out to be the famous Peter Butterworth of the Carry On series, dressed up as a German guard, tagged on the very back with his homemade rifle. And the rifles were constructed out of sides of the hut and carved, and the gun barrel was in fact crushed lead pencil, polished in to look like gunmetal. His webbing was cardboard polished with leather, imitation leather was cardboard.